listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. If you read Ayelet Waldman's new book, Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace, you'll learn a lot about the author and her family. You'll learn that in the seventh grade, she went trick-or-treating as a can-can dancer. You'll learn about the moment she first laid eyes on her future husband. You'll learn what she learned from her feminist mother. You'll learn the startling and illuminating reasons behind her naming a plum tree in her backyard Rocket Ship. Most importantly, you'll gain some sane perspectives on the challenges of motherhood, and I guarantee you'll cheer her humor, her sometimes painful insights, and her bracing honesty. In fact, I was reading it last night on the couch and fell asleep and dreamed about my mother, which was quite a kind of beautiful segue there. Ayelet Waldman is the daughter of is the author of Daughter's Keeper and Love and Other Impossible Pursuits. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Salon.com, New York, Elle, Vogue, and many other publications. And she and her husband, the novelist Michael Chabon, live in Berkeley with their four children, and you'll hear more about them tonight. Our other wonderful and accomplished writer tonight is Susan Strait, whose novels include the forthcoming Take One Candle, Light a Room, and High Wire Moon, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the California Book Award. Her essays and stories have appeared in numerous publications, including the Los Angeles Times and Salon, and on NPR's All Things Considered, among other outlets, and she's a recipient of many awards. She was born in Riverside, teaches at UC Riverside, and she has three daughters, one of whom is here tonight, and we welcome her. Without further ado, please welcome Ayelet Waldman and Susan Strait. Ayelet's going to start with a reading, and then we'll proceed to the conversation. Thanks so much.
Hey. Thank you all so much for coming out on such a nice night. I'm just going to start really from the beginning and read just until we get bored. I'll do that wonderful writer trick where you're dying, you've slipped into your coma, and then I'll say, another chapter? Okay. Does that just kill you? No more. No, I'll read for no more than a few minutes. And this is just really from the beginning of the book. I busted my first bad mother in the spring of 1994 on a train in San Francisco. She was sitting on the edge of her seat, her young daughter standing between her legs. She had two barrettes clamped between her lips and a hair elastic stretched around the fingers of one hand. With her other hand, she was brushing the little girl's long, dark hair, trying to gather the slippery strands into a neat ponytail. It was not going well. She would smooth one side and then lose her grip on the other or gather up the hair in the front, only to watch the hairs at the nape of the girl's neck slide free. The ride was rough, the Muni car bucking and jerking along, causing the little girl periodically to lose her footing. When the driver took a turn too sharply, the girl stumbled forward, her sudden motion causing her mother once again to lose hold of the ponytail. With a frustrated click of her tongue, the mother yanked a handful of the girl's hair hard and hissed, "Stand still!" That's when, indignant, confident that someday when it was my turn to brush my own daughter's hair, I would never be so abusive, I leaned forward in my seat, caught the woman's eye, and said in a voice loud enough for everyone in the train car to hear, "Lady, we're all watching you." I know. We are always watching the bad mother police force in a perpetual state of alert level orange. Sometimes the avatars of maternal evil that come to obsess us are grave and terrible, like Andrea Yates, who was found not guilty by reason of insanity for drowning her five children in the bathtub. Sometimes our fixation on a particular bad mother has to do with our own racism, as in the national obsession in the 1980s with the mythical welfare queen, described by Ronald Reagan as a woman with, and this is a quote, 80 names, 3 addresses, and 12 social security cards, or the current hysteria about undocumented women giving birth to anchor babies in order to immunize themselves from deportation. And there's my favorite one that we just heard talked about on the floor of Congress, which is that terrorist women are giving birth to anchor babies who will then be part of a secret terrorist cell. Yeah. Sometimes the crime is so lunatic that it approaches a kind of horrible grandeur, like that of Wendy Cook, a prostitute in Saratoga Springs who snorted cocaine off her baby's stomach while she was breastfeeding. And here, I've always been so proud of being able to nurse and read at the same time. As soon as one bad mother fades from view, another quickly takes her place in the dock of the court of public opinion. A few years ago, the dingbat pop starlet Britney Spears was hoisted up as the latest agent of villainy. Her bad mother rap sheet is long and varied. It includes, and I'm sure you guys have forgotten this, so I'll remind you, being committed to a psychiatric facility, losing visitation rights after failing to submit to court-mandated drug testing, driving with her infant son on her lap, and running in her car over the feet of photographers and sheriff's deputies. We can all agree, can't we, that Britney Spears is at best an incompetent mother and at worst a neglectful one. She's far worse than my first caller, the Medea of Muni, who pulled her daughter's hair on the J Church line. So why then do I find myself feeling like she and all the other women like her have gotten a bit of a rough deal? Perhaps because, in a smaller way, at the periphery of the public eye, I was myself made to do the bad mother perp walk. For a Warholian 15, I became fodder for the morning talk shows and gossip blogs, held up to scorn and ridicule as an example of maternal perfidy. My crime? Confessing in the pages of the New York Times style section to loving my husband more than my children. In that essay, I wondered about why so many of the women I knew were not having sex with their husbands, while I still was. And I concluded that it might be because they, unlike me, had refocused their passion from their husbands or partners onto their kids. I wrote, "Libido as she once knew it is gone, and in its place is all-consuming maternal desire." And then I spent some time worrying about what was wrong with me. Why hadn't I successfully made the erotic transition a good mother is supposed to make? I wrote that if a good mother was one who loved her children more than anyone in the world, more even than her husband, then I was a bad mother because I loved my husband more than my children. The bad mother police were swiftly on the scene. They speculated down in the toxic mud of the comment sections on blog pages that I was crazy, evil, a menace, that my children should be taken away from me. They cross-examined me on the set of Oprah. And New York City's elite bad mother SWAT team, the warrior shrews of urbanbaby.com, sank their pointy little incisors into my metaphorical ankles. I feel enough of Britney Spears' pain to find myself wondering at the genesis of our current obsession with these varied archetypical manifestations of maternal evil. To a certain extent, of course, we've always been both terrified and titillated by the bad mother. Think Euripides' Medea and Agave, think Jocasta, think Joan Crawford. But I can't help but feel, and perhaps only because I've been tried and convicted of the crime, that there is something especially sharpened and hysterical about contemporary bad mother vitriol. The frequency with which a new bad mother is unmasked and the extent of our interest in each one are, I believe, more than merely symptoms of the contemporary general degeneration of civility. While, granted, the human dum-dum bullets of message boards like Urban Baby hardly exemplify the attitudes of the civil and decent core of American society, they do seem to distill to a vile essence what is widespread societal preoccupation with bad mothers. And I'll leave it at that.
Me too.
All right, you can tell we're both moms because we're both like, don't forget to do that. it's a perfect way to start to sort of, I was going to ask her, so what's a good mother? If she's a bad mother, what's a good mother? So not the caricature version of a good mother.
The real version?
But what do you think is really a good mother?
Oh, anybody who's not me. What is, I think at this point in my life, I actually think the caricature version really has to be something. If you don't actually hurt them, if you try more or less on a daily basis not to neglect and abuse them, I think that should be enough. Right? I mean, obviously that's not the standard we're going to hold ourselves to, but wouldn't it be, because that's all it takes to be a good father. I mean, right? All you have to be to be a good father is just make an appearance. And not even that often. If you make, say, every other parent-teacher night, you're golden. If you make dinner 5 nights a week but not 7 nights a week, you're held up as some kind of paragon of paternity. I mean, I think we should strive for something akin to that. But of course, you know, my son is being bar mitzvahed on Saturday, and I'm here now in Los Angeles, and there's this little voice in the back of everything's done. The bar mitzvah's prepared. There's nothing I could be doing but fretting in Berkeley. And there's this voice in the back of my head saying, well, if you were a good mother, you'd be home worrying like you're supposed to be instead of gallivanting around Los Angeles.
That's exactly what okay, there's that voice in the back of your head. Whose voice is that? Is that your mom's voice?
No,
is that
God, this mythical no. My voice? My mother raised me in the 70s. My mother. I don't think my mother spent 5 minutes worrying about whether or not she was a good mother. My mother was worried about, you know, having enough money to feed us, and with her 6 kids, so like shoes was a big deal.
Right.
She was her idea of, you know, decent parenting was to open the door on Saturday morning, shove us out, and say, you know, be home by dinner time. So I don't really think she women.
It's not
she,
your mom's voice,
but. I think it's the voice. I think it's my own anxiety and my own neurosis writ large and then multiplied exponentially in the faces of all the other overeducated, overprivileged women that I see in my life.
What's really...
A little toxic circle.
Well, what's fascinating is, like I said, I mean, I... We've known each other for a while now, right?
No,
a long
we're
time.
Old.
We're old.
Yes.
So we've established that. But we've also established that you're younger than me and you will be forever.
Forever.
See?
Always.
Forever. That's always.
But you'll always be thinner than me, so it kind of evens out.
when we first met and when we were talking, and so we should just get this out of the way. How old are your kids now?
15, about to be 13 on Saturday, the day of his bar mitzvah, 9 and 7.
Right. And I have 21... My nephew lives with me now, and he's 20, and I have one who's 18 and going to be 19 next week, and 14. So we're sitting here having this voice in your head, and I do want to direct it in a really specific way, which is a little way toward art, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time to write. It takes a lot of time to make any kind of art. It takes time to dance, to sing, to write poetry, to write fiction. It takes time to paint. It takes time to garden. It takes time to do anything that I would consider art. So with that little voice in the back of your head, you should be doing this. When do you write? Where do you write? How do you write?
I mean, that's actually the hardest part. The actual time, I mean, my kids go to school. You know, they're all school age now. So theoretically, I should have this day. I draw, and by the way,
wait for college. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, I don't have to go in today.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what?
I should be able to write carpal to carpal, and that is my theoretical schedule. And when I'm not, you know, I don't know what, because when you're a writer, people think that means that you don't work, so you're expected to bake all the cupcakes for whatever the school, nursery school appreciation breakfast, or in my case, buy all the cupcakes for the nursery school appreciation. But
do you let yourself write at home then?
But the problem I have is not the actual time, because there is that time in the day. The problem that I'm missing as a writer, and that's only gotten harder as the kids have gotten older, is the space in your head to work, because they take up more. I feel like the older they get, the more space they take up in your head. I remember we had this great pediatrician, Dr. Friedman, here in LA when I first had my first baby, and I came in and I was God, why did I come in? I came in because I said to him, look, every time you throw her in the air like this, her eyes roll back in her head. And I kept doing it. And he said, so stop that. Don't. But Dr. Friedman said to me, little children, little problems. And I remember, you know, in my sort of sleep-deprived fog thinking, this is as big a problem as I can handle right now. But now, in retrospect, it really is true. And they take up more psychic energy the older they are. And I have my work day, and I can be really productive, and I can get my work done. But what I'm missing is that space where what I'm thinking about is my book, and what I'm worrying about is my book. And when the random thoughts that occur to me are thoughts that have to do with what I'm working on. And that's what I think you miss. And I know my husband has the same thing. It's not unique to motherhood. I think that's as a parent and trying to be a parent and a writer or trying to be a parent and an artist, that's where the juggle happens. But you know what? Like, I keep reminding myself, then I get like, oh, it's so hard. I have no psychic space. Then I think, you know, I could be working 15 hours a day mining coal. So shut up.
Well, one of my neighbors across the street, she has an autistic son. And so he's 20, and then she has an older daughter, and she's a single mom suddenly after all these years, and she is doing home health care for someone who's 80 years old, has Alzheimer's, and is incontinent. So she does that all day, and every night.
You're whining.
Well, no. I just mean every night we talk at the fence, and it is funny because she's a good mother, I'm a good mother, you're good. And, like, she doesn't have that voice in her head, you know? So let's go back to the voice in the head. Like, she doesn't have the voice in the head saying you're not doing enough. So is it because we think so much? You know, we're good mothers, right? But you look at,
right.
To get back to your book, all these amazing things that you wrote about.
My heart is now out on a platter for this woman. And I'm thinking, what can I get her, like?
No.
Have meals delivered immediately.
We both have
Which
chickens.
Side of
we're fine. We're fine. Listen, the thing is, though, like I said, I talked
to her.
Never
going to complain again.
She doesn't.
You guys can go home. I have nothing to talk about except whining, so it's done.
We whine. No, but that's fine because we're whining on paper, so that's our job, right? So you whined on paper, and it was amazing because you whined about stuff that was so universal to everyone.
Well, what's so interesting is I get sometimes people say, oh, this is the problem of the privileged elite. And I'll think, you know, yeah, it's definitely a problem of privilege. But then I get letters from women who feel the same way, and right. They're, you know, struggling to hold down two jobs, and they're managing to feed their kids when their husbands have left them, and they're, you know, working night and day. And I think, and they too spend time beating themselves up about being a bad mother. It's like a, you know, none of that trickle down economic theory worked,
no.
But the trickle down toxic theory, that works.
The trickle down worry.
That the neurosis and misery of the elite can trickle down to the entire society. So you're welcome.
Think about it this way, because I was going to go back to the your mom, my mom, your husband Michael's mom, right? Think about the way we were raised in the 70s, 60s and 70s, like you said. There wasn't, in other words, we weren't all tied together with our parents. You know, I mean, my mom, she did her thing. She was worried about her stuff. She wanted to do what she wanted to do. And we were there, but you're right. It was go outside and don't come back till dark. And when we said, what if we're thirsty? She's like, that's what hoses are for.
And
that's,
you know,
what hoses are for.
That childhood world. I mean, that kind of society of children. I mean, it's not like that was a safe and rosy place. I mean, come on, how many of us remember it? There was a lot. We did a lot of awful, dangerous, horrible things. But at the same time, we lived in a world of children. We lived in a world where you had a kind of internal cartography of your neighborhood as a kid. You knew, you know, where the scary dog was, and you knew where all the kids lived, and you knew if you rode your bicycle this way, you were going to go by that house with the lady who sometimes yelled. Like, you had this whole world that you lived in that was completely independent of your parents, and our children don't have that. They're kind of parachuted in. Sometimes I feel like there were years where I thought, my kids, if you drop them four blocks from their house, there's no guarantee they can make it home, you know, because they'd never had to do it. They'd been ferried to and from places. I remember times where we were in the car and we're, you know, setting out on a family trip, and it's hour number three, and my son would pipe up from the back and he'd be like, where are we going? And he had no idea we weren't, like, going to the grocery store. As he's so used to being driven, it never occurred to him to ask. And, you know, when I'm feeling this is yet another thing to be guilty about. When I'm feeling, you know, worried about my kids and I'm worried about art and like, what happens to the create, you know, where are artists going to come from when we haven't given any room to our children to be bored, to create inner lives for themselves? I don't know. That's a very scary thought.
They're good at YouTube.
Yeah, you're very good at YouTube. We did this thing where we rent a house for a month in the summer, and it's in Maine, and it's in the middle of all these meadows. And the first summer we were there, I said, go out and play. And how many of you have read Michael Pollan's incredible book? Do you remember the free-range chickens? So they're like born and they're hatched and they live in these big houses. And at some point in their lives, they open doors at either end of the chicken coop and they say, go out, chickens. But of course, the chickens have never been outside and they're not going to go out because this is their coop. And they kind of look at that scary door and that's their free range. And I felt like our kids were free range kids the way those chickens were free. We were like, open the door, go out and play. And they kind of stared at me, stricken. And what I did was I gave them a complicated, shopping list, scavenger hunt. I said, you may not come back to this house until you have a rock the size of a quarter, 3 red leaves, 1, you know, a purple flower, and 2 four-leaf clovers. And they were gone for hours.
For hours.
Hours and hours. And they trudged out there like it was some horrible assignment, you know, and we could see them in the distance looking for the rock. And then finally, after enough days, they were like, oh, we can play out here. This is a world you can play in.
You must not have black flies at that house.
No, we girl, miss those little black flies. Oh. Come back when you have 500 black fly bites.
That's an amazing one. That's a good assignment.
You can't come home until you have 4 mosquito bites.
4 mosquito bites. Michael has a great essay about that.
Yes.
I probably
just plagiarized his. I do have this problem of like thinking I've written things that he's written, and I spout these, and he'll be sitting there next to me, and he'll be like, I wrote that. I'm like, no. I'm sure I thought of that. Are you sure?
But you lived it with him.
Yeah.
You read the draft.
I did so. And I probably thought of it first. And,
well,
yeah, who knows? Who knows at this point?
I do remember reading that essay of his, and it was about that freedom that he had, and it was about the woods, kind of like the woods. You had the woods, and you knew about it. But it's. I hope we're not going too fast for you. We haven't seen each other for a while, so it's just going to be kind of like, so what about that other thing? So how did it feel to have him having a parenthood book and you having a parenthood book the same year?
First of all, it was a total, I know this that sounds impossible, but it was a complete coincidence. I was writing Bad Mother, and what happened was we support A26 Valencia, which you guys have an A26 here in Los Angeles. It's this amazing organization that does after-school tutoring and in-school tutoring and writing workshops for kids. And I think yours is in Echo Park. Anyway, we were trying to figure out a way to do a fundraiser for A26. And I said, well, let's find a bunch of your essays on writing, and then you can put out a book on writing for to fundraise for A26. So he just handed me all of his essays, and I was pulling out essays on writing, and then I said to him, you know, you've actually got a book here about fatherhood and manhood. You have this whole, you know, there are holes in it. You need to fill it out, but there's an actual book here about fatherhood that you could, you know, publish and help send our children to college. And so he started working on the missing pieces of that, and then they just coincidentally were finished at the same time. And then the paperbacks actually came out simultaneously, which was a little weird. But neither of us ever expected to be writing those books, and we certainly didn't expect to be writing them at the same time. And it's a source of unending amusement for our children that we've written books about parenthood, as if we have any expertise that, you know, isn't. I tell them it's just all about the mistakes we've made so that everyone can avoid them.
All right.
But it's been a little weird.
But that, it again, so...
It would have sucked if he had gotten on Terry Gross and I hadn't. I can just say, I've never felt competitive with him ever. Like, really, how could I? I mean, that would just be pathetic and sad, and I would be on the losing end of that all the time.
But the other half of that is he did not have to go on Oprah with you when you got yelled at
about
wanting to have sex with him.
No, and in fact... That.
In fact, Rosette and I, we rushed home from school. I picked her up early so we could watch you.
Watch that Oprah. Because
my youngest one, Rosette, the 14-year-old, she just thinks I yelled. She's just like, let's go watch I yelled on Oprah. And then she's like, look, her hair looks beautiful. 10 minutes later, dang, they are mad that I yelled. Yeah. She was like, dude, I can't watch this anymore. They're yelling
not
at her.
Not only did he not come with me, but about a week before they called, he was, so this essay had come out and it was causing a little bit of a stir, and he was sort of lying face down on his bed groaning. Why? Because he had just begun a correspondence, an email correspondence with this writer who he idolized. Someone, it was Greil Marcus. Any of you know, he's a great writer about rock and roll. He's amazing. And Michael had been reading him his whole life, it seemed. And he had just begun to email, and he was so excited about one of his literary idols emailing with him. And that morning, he'd received an email that was addressed, "Dear Sex God."
Yeah.
So he's like lying on his bed, groaning with horror. And he says, "Oh, well, at least I should be grateful you didn't go on Oprah to talk about our sex life."
Oh, God.
And then a week later, I was like, did you mean what you said about Oprah? Because, oh, my God, she's on the phone. So...
Was he upset?
No, he, you know, we have a lot of children, and they're in private school. So when Oprah called, he was like, go. If it'll sell books, go. Neither of us expected what was going to happen on that. Like, I thought, this is my fantasy about Oprah. I was going to go on Oprah Winfrey, and the two of us were going to sit like this, and we're going to talk about how great my books are. And then Oprah and I were going to be best friends forever. And then there was going to be applause, and I was going to go watch my Amazon ranking just go through the roof. That's what I imagined was going to happen. What actually happened was
You got yelled at.
I flew to Chicago. And I should say that I developed this monstrous pimple on the plane on the way to Chicago, which, of course, I kept trying to pop. So by the time I got to the stage, the set, I was only thinking about the zit. I mean, I swear, like, it preceded me into the room by, like, 3 minutes. And all I wanted to know was, were these people going to be able to spackle out the rest of my face in order to make that zit not cast a shadow over the entire set? So I wasn't paying attention to anything but my incredible narcissistic pimple obsession. And all of a sudden, at some point, I hear this like cackling, shrieking noise. And I said, what is going on? And the producer says, well, I was just trying to explain that to you. We've assembled a group of moms to have a kind of alternative living room format. And they hate you. But hey, you're a criminal defense attorney. You're used to hostile juries. You'll be fine. And at that point, it really was, like, it was terrifying. I mean, they were so angry. I mean, they were, when I walked out on the set, I think I write about this in the book, I walked out on the set, and they were selecting women from the audience to sit on the stage with me, and they selected one woman, and she was so excited to be selected that she screams, "Let me at her!" and, like, leaps over. And I'm just thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to die. Oh, this is, and I actually, I was like, you know what, I did not sign up for this, and I'm about to, I start to unhook my microphone, and then this door, like about there, opens up, and in a halo of golden light walks a being like someone from another planet, really like a golden goddess of joy. And I mean, Oprah is different from you and me. She looks different. She smells better than we smell. She's just... I was so in love within seconds of seeing her that I wasn't going anywhere. And then she really nailed it by leaning over and putting her hand on my arm, scooching in and whispering in my ear, "The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay was one of the best books I've read in years." So what am I thinking at that moment? I am thinking Oprah Book Club. Right? I am thinking 800,000 books sold. I am thinking I'm going to be rich. I'm going to buy a house in Paris. My children are going to go to college. This is the greatest. And so I wasn't going anywhere. But I will say that Oprah did agree with me, like they promised. And the audience tore me to shreds for the first half of the show. And then, like a cruise ship being turned in midstream, Oprah, as soon as they realized that she agreed with me, it was like I had the imprimatur of golden goddessness. And by the end of the show, they're all like, "Oh, Ayala, we totally agree with Ayala. We just didn't like the way she said it." And most incredibly, they all were like emailing me afterwards, like we're best friends. friends. One woman who let them film her children, I just don't understand why she did this. She was like, you know, the opposite of me. She was the good mother. And so they filmed her. She had like a gymnastics studio in her basement, and they filmed the children doing the gymnastics. And then she had all these stringed instruments, and they were all playing stringed instruments. And then they kept filming her husband like reaching out for her and her walking by him obliviously. I don't know how they got that on camera. And so she emailed me and she said, I am so miserable and I'm unhappy and tell me what to do and help. And I was, and I said, okay, step one, get rid of the harpsichord. We're going to take it from there. So. I don't know what happened after that.
And you thought we weren't going to have anything to talk about, huh? We haven't seen each other for a long time. This is true. But I have to say that Rosette was so upset that she went to the kitchen. We couldn't watch because it was just, they were really angry with you. But, okay, so again, aside from that, what do you think that generation of moms that wants to be the perfect mom does remember about their own childhoods or their own
moms?
Well,
you know, I wonder, like, what was inadequate? I like to blame everything on my mother. That's sort of my modus operandi.
You know, our moms did a good job.
But
my dad, like you said, hey, if you apply the standards that you just said you're going to apply, we're fine because we're all alive. We're here.
Like, exactly. I wonder if it isn't, you know, I've been a feminist since my mother, you know, gave birth to me and read Betty Friedan right away. And but in a way, I kind of blame the feminist movement. And as a feminist, and here's why, don't kill me. Here's why. All of us were raised with this idea. I mean, we didn't say we wanted to be like, you know, a mommy when we grew up. We didn't want to be wives and mothers. Or if we did, we wanted to do that in addition to something else. We all had absolute ambitions as little girls. We wanted to be doctors and lawyers and whatever it is we wanted to do. And it never occurred to us that those ambitions needed to be compromised in any way. And my generation, I'm 45. I'm admitting that on a stage in the Mark Taper Auditorium. My generation, we went to school and we pursued those ambitions, you know, many of us single-mindedly. And then we had children and suddenly we were brought up against this truth, which was that we had changed. And what we wanted out of life had changed, but the world actually didn't change as fast as we did. And the expectations, our expectations were so at odds with the reality. I mean, it turned out, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you could almost say that when I was a little girl, my father worked hard, but he came home from work every night at 6 o'clock. And when the train pulled in from Manhattan into the Ridgewood, New Jersey train station, the 604 or whatever train it was, all the daddies got off the train. Nowadays, you won't find anyone on that 604 train. Nobody gets off the train till 8 o'clock at night. And the reason is it's just when women entered the workday suddenly expanded in this dramatic way so that it became virtually impossible to be a committed, involved parent and to work the kind of hours. I mean, you guys all know the kind of hours that people expect you to work. It's insane. So I think what ended up happening is we took so many women of my generation and sort of generation like immediately before and after took all of that ambition and all of that energy, and almost all of us, I mean, God knows not everybody went home and became a stay-at-home mother. Most of us didn't. But everybody made some kind of professional sacrifice of some kind once we had children. But so we took all that energy and that ambition that was thwarted to a certain extent in the workplace, and we channeled that into our children. And that's when you began to see this kind of hysteria about, you know, where our kids every kid needed to get into Yale and they all have to be perfect in this way. That great Judith Warner book, Perfect Madness, I think describes that really well. And inevitably that ends up feeling kind of hollow. And inevitably you start beating yourself up about it, because the satisfaction of your ambition rests on the shoulders of like a 5-year-old who's, you know, gonna screw up because that's what you're supposed to do when you're a kid, then you start to kind of, you know, you end up eating yourself from the inside out. At least that's what happened to me.
Well, but I mean, I also
maybe think your kids never made mistakes and they're perfect and you're happy because they're perfect.
Well, look, I have these.
Don't buy my book if you have perfect children.
I have these four big, gigantic people at my house, and everyone's taller than me. And there's a lot of taquitos and cooking and endless amounts of fish tacos. But I feel really lucky that everybody still wants to hang out. You know, I'm okay with that, right?
Right.
So I figure the way to judge, I mean, I'm okay with yours too. Like if everybody's got
what
their toes and
fingers. Don't want to hang out with
no,
me.
No, no, no. Well, you'll,
then
you won't
I'll
know
really
yet.
Suck.
All I'm saying is if they still call
if I
you.
I just stayed at home the week before his bar mitzvah, he would have loved me forever.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. They don't care about that. They don't care about that. My kids, now I'm going to be in big trouble, especially because Delphine has to drive me home. But we have a theory at my house, and it's, oh, she's going to kill me. I can't see you, Delphine, so I'm really happy. My oldest daughter and my middle daughter taught me this. It's DGAF. It's an Inland Empire thing. It's supposed to have a big truck and all that. But aside from the big truck, and I don't have the right hair, it's don't give a fig, right? Okay.
Right.
So there's something.
That's what when.
No, there's
like
a point
that.
Where you come home from
is there
work.
Anybody under 20 in the audience? Can you tell me if that's what we should be aspiring to? Because
no,
I
no,
could
no,
do
no,
that
no.
really easily.
No, the thing for moms is you come home and you don't worry about some of that stuff. Instead, they talked me into watching Scrubs. And I resisted Scrubs forever. I was like, this is the dumbest show. I'm not watching Scrubs. For a year and a half. Turn that crap off. I was, what? Why are they singing? That's a dumb show. And then one Thanksgiving, put all those dishes away, fed all those people. And they're like, Mom, just sit down and watch Scrubs. We watched Scrubs for 5 hours. I didn't even get up to pee. Okay? It was the best day ever. Best day ever was 5 hours of Scrubs with all these kids on the couch.
Right.
And that's all I'm saying is that's what they remember. They do remember the bar mitzvah. And I mean, you guys know what I'm talking about.
You better remember.
But they do remember that I sat down and listened to them and that I watched Scrubs. And now we quote Scrubs. And unfortunately, there are lots of things I wish we didn't quote from Scrubs. But I don't even want to think about some of the stuff my 14-year-old says about Scrubs. But I'm just saying,
right.
That's what
I mean. I think the truth is that kind of anxiety and that kind of toxicity ends up ruining your relationship with, you know, they
have to chill.
You end up being unhappy, and right. You know, nobody wants to be around someone who's unhappy.
Well, I keep trying to teach people the DGAF thing, but they keep calling it DEFCON. So don't go home and tell Michael Susan said something about some DEFCON thing, because it's not like an alert. It's,
right.
Yeah. It's a DGAF kind of thing, but it's fig. Don't say the other word. And okay. In The Bad Mother. The thing is, the essay form is beautiful, all right? And I wanted to talk for a minute about the essay form. To me, is one of the most beautiful forms of writing still out there, along with the short story. Mona's in the audience, and Ellen Slezak, and Diana Wagman, and Carrie, and a lot of other great writers. And I love the short story, and I love the essay. It's just such a beautiful form. Like,
yeah.
I love writing essays. And don't you think that when you write, I mean, you're such a good writer. When you write a beautiful, lyrical, thoughtful essay about something like this, then don't you feel better about it?
It's true. I mean, in particular, it's funny. There's one of the essays in the book is about this second trimester abortion that we had,
right.
And I wrote that experience. I wrote around it, sort of in concentric circles. The first thing I did is I wrote a book that wasn't supposed to be about motherhood at all, and ended up being about the ways we lose our children, and it's about an adult mother and daughter. And it was meant to be a kind of polemic about the drug war, and ended up being a story about a mother and a daughter. And that was kind of the outer ring. That's where I could write about...
That was
like,
the fiction ring.
Yeah, well, sort of the farthest away. Mm-hmm. And as the closest to the experience in time and the farthest away. And then after a little while, I wrote a horror story. I wrote a ghost story about a woman haunted by the ghost of her dead baby. And because it was genre and because it was creepy and it was about the baby's cries coming through a baby monitor, then I had enough distance from it because it, I could, you know, put it in this genre that I could write that circle. And then I wrote Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, which is about a woman whose baby dies of SIDS, which was really close, emotionally close. And then it was only after I wrote all those circles out that I could finally write the essay about the actual experience. But I don't think I ever could have written that essay. I couldn't have written it right away. I couldn't have written it without sort of going through that experience of writing on the outside of it first.
I think that's a beautiful answer, because it's like when I tell my students is sometimes you have to have some distance, and actually that's what fiction allows you to do, right? Is short stories allow you to have a different kind of brain act. It's a whole different brain activity for me when I'm doing essays or fiction. Probably the same
Absolutely.
For you, right?
I mean, it's a break. I love writing essays because I feel like
it's in a way, it's much harder to craft an essay because you're writing about yourself, so you're dealing with all the sort of, you know, putting yourself out there so obviously. But if, for me, it's a relief to write an essay when I'm in the thick of a novel because, first of all, in the same way that writing a short story can be that sort of relief because you can begin it and end it. And when you're in the middle of a novel, it never feels like you're going to finish anything ever again. But also because I don't have to worry about creating a character. I don't have to worry about creating a story. All that's taken care of for me. So all I need to worry about is the words. And that feels like a holiday sometimes.
And that's what I'm saying is then when you're done writing an essay about it, don't you feel a little less of some of that toxicity and that
absolutely
gets rid of it?
I mean, I think, certainly so for that Rocket Ship experience, that was the name that my son had given the baby, and we were sort of our placeholder name. That I honestly don't feel, I mean, I sound sort of, a little gushy to say, but I don't feel like I really healed from that experience until I could actually write it and sort of write the whole thing through. And that was a huge step for me. I mean, that was how I realized that, you know, I was a lawyer before I was a writer. I was a federal public defender here in LA. And I started writing because I couldn't think of anything else to do when I left my job. And it took for years, I wouldn't say that I was a writer because my husband was a famous writer and it was so tacky and, oh my God, write the writer's wife. So I would say, I'm on maternity leave. And like after 4 books, it was sort of like, really? Nobody's holding a job for you. So I don't think you can call that maternity leave. So then I was like, well, I'm just a mystery writer. And then when I stopped writing mysteries and I was writing other things, I was like, well, I'm writing. And it took until that happened with that experience and that I was in this kind of hysterical grief in the wake of it. I was really profoundly depressed for about 6 months, and I realized that the only way I was going to lift myself out of the depression is if I started writing again. That I realized, oh, wow, I'm actually a writer. I'm not just, you know, someone doing this on the side while she waits to go back to her real job, which is what? I mean, only a crazy person would ever hire me as a lawyer again.
Don't you think we're lucky?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I... You know, Kinahora, my grandmother would die if she heard me say on a stage in front of people that I was lucky. That just tempts the evil eye. But I feel so grateful.
I said, don't you think we're lucky? And you could have just said, yeah.
Yeah, and then spat over
nothing.
My shoulder.
And then I'm going to get the bad luck. But Delphine's driving, so I'm okay with it. I'm saying I think sometimes when I think about my kids and all these kids, I mean, because my fears are different fears from yours because I live in a totally different place.
Right.
Like mine is every single night. Are they going to come home? Every single night. Sensei, my nephew, is he going to come home? Delphine hates hearing that too. Every single night, there's only one thing I care about. Is everybody home? So their curfew is 2 o'clock. I'm up till 2 o'clock. Is everybody home? Is everybody home? But I'm still lucky because I could write about that. So right. I don't have to go beating my brains out and killing myself and drinking because then it would be hard to stay up till 2 worrying about everybody coming home because then I'd be sleeping because I'd have had wine. But no, instead I have another cup of tea and then just sit there looking out the window waiting for everybody to come home. I feel like I'm really the luckiest person in the world because I can write. Whatever genes and structure that we got, how did that happen to you that you became a writer, that's how you worked out your stuff?
I mean, it's so funny because it really did feel accidental to me because I made a toast at our wedding. My husband was married before and his first wife was a poet. They were divorced when we met. I didn't live out like that novel that I wrote about a woman who steals another husband. Not true.
Stealing a husband from a poet.
Their marriage had kind of, one of the reasons that it fell apart was because they had this sort of literary competition. And I made a toast at our wedding in which I told all the people assembled for our wedding that I would never be a writer. I would always have health insurance. I would never try to compete with him. So when I first realized that I was going to be doing this, it was terrible. I didn't tell Michael at first. I told him I was working on a law review article, which is what I was supposed to be doing. I was teaching at Loyola Law School. Here in this neighborhood, in fact. And I would go to the law library, and at first I would just sleep. I'd just sit there sleeping in the law library. And when I woke up, I could never remember the topic that I was supposedly writing this law review article about. I would just say, what am I, can't remember what I'm writing about. And then I started writing this murder mystery and sneaking in. I'd come home from the law library and my husband would say, so how's it going? I'd be like, oh, it's great. It's really, he's like, can I read? I'm like, oh, you wouldn't want to read. It's so technical. And then when I had about 50 pages, I said, okay, I'm going to show you this and I want you to tell me, does it suck? Because I don't want to do it and I feel really bad. And he just said, well, just give it to me. And he read the first 50 pages and the only thing he said was, keep going. And I was like, well, just, I don't, you know, I don't want to fail. I hate failure. Just tell me now if I should throw that. He's like, just keep going.
So and the toast so I kept thing, going. You know, is there some kind of bad luck thing where you broke up the toast and stuff too?
Yeah, I was just not telling you making any more toasts.
Okay.
So
I was just remembering my brother-in-law's was the best man at our wedding and his toast was, go forth and multiply, y'all. And then he was done. Like that was the whole toast.
And you did.
We did. So we're, yeah. I'm glad I didn't say anything. I haven't heard you say that. All right.
I'm glad he didn't tell to me because even without that toast, we had four kids. Can you imagine?
All right.
Oy.
We have to talk about something weird now. A little odd, but she already mentioned it. And I thought the audience might be interested in this too. All right. There's this thing. You were writing for Salon a lot. That's right. How we met because we started writing. We wrote a lot of essays for Salon. One of my favorite places to write. I really miss, by the way, writing for Salon, because we could write about things for Salon that we could never write about anywhere else. Like, I wrote stuff about being a single mom, and the thing is, when you were, Salon.com was this great, one of the very first online...
Yeah, I think it was the first online magazine, it was Slate or one Salon, of the first.
Right,
yeah.
And it was one of the very first online magazines, and I remember that Ayala and Anne Lamott, there was this shift that happened, and for the people who read Salon online, you'll know what I'm talking about. There was this kind of shift where it went from people just reading it to where the comments became really, really important.
Horrible moment in time.
So I thought this was—I had never gotten to talk about this with anyone.
I think that's what killed Salon. I mean, I will believe to the end of my days that the—I mean, it's not dead; it still exists.
Well, let me explain so that if people who haven't, because people are like, "What does this mean?" So if you read an article on Salon.com, you know, in the first part, we would write the article, and you just. There it was. It was just like a magazine,
and
right?
And there'd be letters. Letters to the editor.
There would be letters to the editor.
And selected.
And then came a time, and I hadn't written anything for a little while, when all of a sudden you were, as is common now, you could comment, right? So the reader comments was all of a sudden, I noticed it, because I was a devoted Salon reader, and I'd be like, and Anne Lamott and Ayala got the worst comments ever and the most comments. And people were like, you should kill yourself now.
Oh,
and take her kids away. And what,
it's amazing.
And what happened was people start reading the article. They were only reading the comments. And don't you think that detracted from what we did?
Oh, absolutely. And I actually really do think it, because as soon as the, I think it kills it, because what happens is you're a normal human being and you're like, ooh, is that who the audience is reading this website is? I don't want to be part of that. And you don't read it anymore because those people are so completely crazy. It boggles my mind what people will say in the comment sections of websites. Normal, decent human beings will say the most unbelievably shocking things. I have a chapter on Bad Mother where I like set myself the task of reading all the hate mail, all the hateful comments, and like reproducing some of it. And it was, I mean, I do think, you know, I am asking for it. Someone who is as thin-skinned as I am has no business writing essays and certainly has no business writing controversial essays. So it's like my own, you know, how dare I complain when I put myself out there like that? But oh my God, the things people will say.
But it's to me, what I thought that the audience might find interesting too is it is a big difference between you write something controversial in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and you go speak at a public forum. And somebody can stand up during a question and answer period, which is coming, you're going to have your chance, and say, well, I thought that was a terrible thing you wrote.
Right.
And then that person's sitting right there looking at you, and you're looking at them, and you have a conversation. But to have 600 comments, you know, online where people are saying you should kill yourself, that's not an engaging forum. And
or
so that's
New York
what's
Times,
scary about it.
The letters
know?
To the editor, and then when they picked up that essay in the New York Times, the letters to the editor ran like 10-1 positive. And one of the reasons is because when you're, if you're going to sit down and write a letter and sign your name to it, even when they're negative, even when you take issue, you're there somehow. normally there's a little more thought.
That's a public forum.
And it's a public forum, and you feel like your name is going to be attached, and they don't allow anonymous letters. So there's a kind of responsibility. But but the anonymous comment section, you know, some of my favorite bloggers now don't let people comment on their websites, and people get all up in arms about that. But I completely understand this. If Andrew Sullivan, who I can't believe now he's like one of my favorite bloggers, and like before Obama, we agreed about nothing politically, and now I'm like, he supported Obama, so he's all right by me. But if he allowed comments on his blog page, that's all the discussion would end up being about is those comments. It wouldn't end up being, you wouldn't be reading him, you'd be reading this kind of hysterical, you know, circle of loathing.
I like the idea that we're more democratic in that the internet has allowed people to comment, and I like that. But I think that there's a lack of civility.
Exactly.
And so what I thought, it was just perfect to bring it up because she was the one person that I was dying to ask this, because it was Anne Lamott and Ayala. I wrote an essay about serving about Memorial Day in my family's house, which is all meat. And that's because people grew up not having any meat. So there's meat in everything except for the ambrosia, which would be disgusting, right? But I mean, there's meat in everything. And I got all these comments like that I was a horrible person for eating meat. And I don't even eat the meat. You know, like my daughter's a vegetarian, but it was the idea that there was a cultural reason why people in our family ate meat. And then people were mad at me. And I was like, why are you mad?
It is amazing. But the other side of it, but like that is our reality now. I mean, the comment section is society. So we just have to like put on our flak jackets and go forth and try. And so what I do is I have like absolute rules. I don't Google myself because that way lies disaster. I don't read. I can tell now whether an email is going to be hate mail or fan mail within the first few words. I don't read the hate mail. I just delete it. I figure if someone takes issue with something I say and writes a thoughtful critique, then I feel like you engaged with the material. I owe it to you to engage with your letter. Right. But if you're just there to tell me I'm fat, I can tell myself I'm fat. I don't need you to do it for me. But there is this kind of self-protection you have to do.
Well, okay, I'm going to do one thing now, and then we're going to open it up for questions. Ayala kind of already answered this. This is her new novel, Red Hook Road. And the question I was going to end with was that, does your brain go to a different place when you're writing a novel and when you're writing your essays? And you kind of already answered that, but I just read this really interesting. One writer said he has two desks. He has a desk for nonfiction and a desk for fiction.
Must have a much bigger house than I do.
Well, I was going to say the same thing because I've just got the little notebook and I'm still writing in my car. And if I had two cars, like a car to write fiction and a car to write nonfiction, I would be really, really happy. But right now I'm writing in a Mercury Villager that's dead.
I have a file on my computer that's, you know, it's so funny. I just got, here's like a whole little writer trick. I just got a tread desk. Oh my God, I know this is going to change my life. I've only had it for a week.
Wait.
But it's a slow treadmill that fits under my desk, and I walk.
While you're sitting?
While I'm writing. So I'm standing up and typing. You have to walk really slowly. It turns out you can only walk like 1.5 miles an hour. Apparently, you can get up to 3 if you're super, super talented, but I'm never going to get by. I'm like too. I've already fallen off the thing like 4 times. But I know this is going to make me so thin. I can just tell. Because I spend like 5 hours a day at my desk. If I spend that 5 hours a day walking, I am going to be, it's just wait till the paperback tour for Red Hook. I'm going to be so different looking. You're not even going to recognize me. You're going to be like, who is that tall, thin person on stage?
I was going to, the two desk thing, we have the tread desk thing. It's a perfect time for questions, and there's a person with a microphone, and she's happy to come and get you.
Can you call
on
people,
Susan? Yeah. It always seems rude to point and go like that.
But see, no, there you go.
No,
there's
wait,
a person right
Oprah
there.
But Oprah does that so much better. Right? And then also you had your hand up too. Doesn't she do it better? I bet she does.
I was so focused on how wonderful she smelled. I didn't notice how she pointed.
Okay.
It's really good. It's like vanilla and lavender and beautiful all wrapped up into one.
If the question was,
every
what does Oprah smell like?
Universe.
You kind of better come up with a different one.
Damn, sorry. I knew you were going to ask that.
When your husband was here, I asked him about this incident on the Oprah show. And he just said, I think she's beautiful and sexy and I love her.
Oh, so, oh my God. I'm going to text him right now about how sweet he is. That's so nice.
But what I was struck by in reading the article from the New Yorker and when you were on Oprah is that, to me, it sounded like this was really a big Jewish value in terms of Jewish culture. And I was wondering if you would talk about that
a little bit. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because I got a tremendous amount of email from rabbis and also from priests and ministers because it's a Jewish value because it's a biblical value. I mean, the Bible says, I don't remember what chapter and verse it's in, but you know, it says cleave unto your husband. It does not say cleave unto your children. And it was amazing to me how many, it was so satisfying to get, you know, an email. It's always satisfying to get an email from a Lubavitcher Rebbe because, not the Rebbe himself, but, you know, a rabbi. So I got all this great, because that would be a trick, wouldn't it? I got these great responses from them. And I went on Mormon radio, and they were like, amen, sister. We don't like all that stuff you say about gay marriage. Forget that. But we love what you're saying about, you know, straight marriage because that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, that's what the Bible says. And, you know, there's this old saying, and I don't know if it's a Jewish saying or if it's just an old saying, which is the most important thing a man can do for his children is love their mother. And you say that and you go, oh, that's so sweet. And then you turn that on its head and say that about a mother. And you're like, oh, wait, that doesn't sound right. The most important thing a mother can do for her children is haunt their lives and make them feel guilty. Like, you know, when your image of the perfect mother is like Oedipus Rex. Remember that Woody Allen movie, The Head Over? So, yeah. It is. That was the most satisfying thing about that experience. Turns out priests email. Who knew they had time with all that other stuff? Can't believe I just said that. Please don't tape this. I love priests. Well, it's interesting because I was very afraid. And they don't read the Times, turns out, my kids. Who knew? Your perfect children probably do. Mine don't. If they didn't watch Oprah, which they didn't, it was at least possible that somebody would and would talk to them about it. So I was very nervous. And I sat them down and I said with, you know, great trepidation, I wrote this thing and this is what it says and I explained it and I looked at my daughter is just sitting there and finally I'm done and she goes, duh, and walks away. And, you know, I was just talking about this with my son who's turning 13 on Saturday and I said, I was asking him and I said, so how do you feel about that? Because you were obviously much younger when this happened. What does it seem to you now? And he said, you know, here, the truth is, Mom, so many of my friends' parents are divorced that, like, I know you're not going anywhere. And that makes me, you know, that's nice to know. And my daughter, I swear, I have this daughter who's the nicest person on the, like, I've never met anyone as nice as Ida Rose. She's named after my two grandmothers who were many things nice, neither of them. So it just goes to show you. But Ida Rose wrote this poem for her brother that she's going to read at his bar mitzvah. And the last line of the poem is, Zeke, I love you as much as mommy loves daddy. I know, right? Isn't that fabulous? And it was so heartwarming. So I think, you know, I'm sure there will be moments where they throw that up in my face. My big worry isn't that they're going to be mad at me for not having made them the center of their universe. Because, you know, God knows they know how much time. They wish I spent a little less time worrying about them. But my worry is that it's going to be a burden when they're looking for a mate, that knowing that the standards of what it means to have a life partner are going to be really, really high. And I don't want them to settle, but at the same time, it's, you know, I'm really, really lucky in my husband. I mean, you know, Kanahora. And I don't, you know, not many people get to marry him. And I just hope that they find that they aren't crippled by that, you know?
Okay, moving on from the not crippling your kids. Next question. Anybody else?
Yes.
Yeah, I can't see very well with the bright lights.
Thanks. First of all, I hope your son has a great time this Saturday.
I hope so, too.
He's got a
whole drosh about Doctor Who. How could that be bad?
Oh, cool.
I know,
cool.
Right?
Got to hear how it goes from Pinhas
only
to
in
Doctor
Los
Who.
Angeles. I say the word drosh in Northern California. People are like, what? It's a speech about the Torah.
I was wondering what you thought about this question that you asked about where does the voice of Bad Mother come in? Because I haven't read your book yet. Now I definitely have to.
There's a particular chapter I'm going to point you to.
Okay.
It's about housework and men. Go on. And the wonderful benefits that will accrue to you in all ways if you do housework.
It's called foreplay.
That's my point, baby. Now he's lost, totally made him lose his train of thought.
I'm there.
Thinking about other stuff now.
It seems like there's two levels of Bad Mother. There's the horror story mother, the mm-hmm. mother who kills her children or abandons them or dangles, or the bad father like Michael Jackson, dangle them out a window. But it seems like there's this other level of the self-judgment,
right,
or the judgment of others in the subway train, for example. And I wonder if you think that that comes from popular culture rather than from our parents.
No, I don't think it comes from our parents. I think it comes from our own. I think that those both, I mean, there have always been parents who are terrible parents. But I think the reason we become so obsessed with it nowadays is because it makes us feel better. Like, you look and you say, well, I didn't drown him in a bathtub, right? So how bad could I possibly be? And that's because we were so obsessed with that because we feel this weird sense of guilt and anxiety. So we latch on to these stories that make us feel better about what kind of mothers we are. So, you know, I may not be, you know, I forgot snack for the 55th day in the row, but hey, you know, at least I love my children more than my husband, you know, ha. So, I mean, I think that there's this way that it all comes from this inner anxiety, because really, if we felt better about ourselves, we'd read about Andrea Yates and we'd say, that poor woman and those poor children and what a nightmare that was. And we'd have some compassion and we wouldn't be completely obsessed with it the way we were when that case happened. I mean, what was that a story about? That was a story about, you know, postpartum depression and don't homeschool in a bus.
And nobody paying,
right. Yeah, exactly.
Nobody to
and
call.
No help. Nobody
no,
to
No neighbor
know.
To call and say, I really need to talk to somebody. Yeah, right. That was the saddest one.
Right, really exactly. So should we go over there?
Sure.
And then we'll go over here.
That's the person I thought I saw you earlier, and then there's a bright light above you.
I'm not a mother. But I wanted to have you comment on
how does your mother feel about that?
But I find it interesting that the generation that was raised sort of in the feminist movement is all pro-woman and let's go and we can do anything we want. And yet that seems to be the same group of women that are judging and poo-pooing one another as bad mothers. Oh, you don't have them in private school. Oh, you don't have, you're
right.
Not using cloth diapers.
Right.
Oh,
I
you're
mean,
not feeding them organic.
We've always been very good at torturing each other. I mean, that, you know, the as wonderfully supportive as women are, and anybody who's ever had, you know, 45 mothers drop off casseroles on your front porch when you, you know, broke your leg or whatever it is, there is a way that you know, women are good at making each other feel like crap. But there is, I do think this, it is a terrible irony that our generation is at once fulfilling our mother's feminist dreams and also tormenting one another about not being good enough at what? At baking the perfect cupcake? I remember I had this, I have a friend who actually does bake the perfect cupcake, and she was on her way into school for her kid's birthday, and she had these two trays of just unbelievable cupcakes. And I don't do that kind of stuff. I'm just not very good at it. I buy beautiful baked goods. And she tripped and fell and smashed them. And I felt horrible, horrible for her. And there was this, then I all of a sudden I realized there's this tiny little voice in me was like, that's what you get. I mean, oh my God, you know, this is my, like, someone I love so completely, and I felt so bad. And in fact, I then bought her their cupcake transporting devices that you can actually, they're like Tupperware, they have things. And now I bought her a set of cupcake transporters, probably because I felt so guilty for that moment where of Schadenfreude. And why? What was that about? I don't want to see those. I wanted one of those damn cupcakes. I wanted to eat it. But because I feel guilty about not being able to do that for my kids. I mean, how ugly is that?
We had a bunch of hands in this section about that and that.
So should we take two more? Is that right?
Yeah,
so I think
we have.
Let's take here this lovely woman. Mona, you just talk to me in the car, and then we'll take this woman right here. Yes, you right there.
Hi. So my question is sort of like if you can comment on this, but I think the bad mother, part of it comes from this investment, like you said, you make. Mm-hmm. Because you've made this compromise, and so you make this investment.
Right.
And we want our investments to pay off.
Exactly.
And we don't have the control. And how these, are there bad mothers that, like, you know, go bad later? Like the Mommy Dearest kind of, you know, because you talked a lot about, like, Britney Spears being sort of, you know, postpartum chaos, drugs,
right,
whatever.
Right.
But I think there's that sort of, I've been ripped off. Like my kids, you know, didn't make the perfect attendance, or, you
right.
know, I, you know, only 6 of the 12 kids in the class came to our birthday party. What's wrong with us? And I mean, I'm being pretentious with it, but I do think there's a part that you go,
oh, absolutely.
Oh, you're only reading at the, you know, less than, you know, you're supposed to be reading. I should do more. And there's a lot of pressure because the school.
I remember I called up my mother and I was crying because my daughter wasn't reading. I was like, she's only reading in a first grade level. And there's this silence on the other end of the line. And then my mother says, honey, she's in first grade. Because that just wasn't, you know, it's that old, you know, all the children are above average. And I think it is true that when you've made a sacrifice, it had better be worth it. You know, do you know what I gave up? I gave up this career. So, and, you know, I'm doing trusts and estates instead of criminal defense or whatever it is. So that, and you know, I sacrificed on the altar of your perfection, and you dare to betray me by being imperfect. I mean, the thing that kills me the most is I have 3 of my kids have learning issues, and the thing that breaks my heart is this idea that they might think that they failed. And sometimes I just thank God that I wrote this book before things got so difficult for them in school, because I wrote the book, like you said, I'm so conscious of that voice that when I start to feel that way, like, Jesus, for, you know, how can this be that, you know, I spend so much time and I'm not, you know, a criminal defense attorney like I expect? When that voice starts to you know, percolate in my head, I can sort of quash it out of existence, because it's a tremendous burden to know that your mother's happiness rests on your, you know, on what score you get on the SAT. I mean, for all that these children, you know, they have such a great sense of entitlement now, it's also a tremendous burden. That's why in our house, I always say, it doesn't matter where you go to college. In our house, there's one person who went to Harvard Law School and one person who went to Pitt. And guess which one won the Pulitzer Prize? Moral of that story. Let's take this last question.
I think you have to sit down and watch TV with them and let them tell you what to do, too. No, I do. I think sometimes they tell you if they don't want to do stuff.
Oh,
they don't.
We don't watch television.
Oh, yes, of course you do.
Perfect.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, you
never.
We could watch stuff on their laptops, because that's really all they do now. Anyway, we don't even get to watch TV. We just watch weird
stuff
on the laptop.
I always watch. That's it's so funny. I'm sitting there with my kids. We're all hunched around watching on the laptop, and the 45-inch flat screen TV is dark on the wall.
We actually didn't have a TV or a car for a while, and it worked out pretty well, because we learned just to sit around, huddle together, talk about closeness, right, and watch YouTube weirdness. So
let's take the last question.
I have 100,000 questions, so I'll try to frame one. you know, you're talking a lot about inner anxieties, and you're talking about things that are real, about guilt, about women. And I have read part of your book, and I read the introduction, and I want to hear you talk a little bit about how it's not only inside of us, right?
Right.
It's a huge, larger cultural campaign, let's
say,
about the fact that women are becoming much more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm wondering also what this self-imposed thing that we do about our own anxiety is covering up the fact that we are powerful,
mm-hmm.
and that we can succeed, and that we won't be perfect mothers, and what the hell is wrong with that?
Right. You know, it's so interesting. It's you know, here we all are so worried about what kind of parents we are, and we're such bad mothers, and we live in this contemporary American society where there are all these voices acting as if the simple act of providing health care to our children is somehow betraying our core values. I mean, what's a worse parent than a parent who won't take care of the health of its children? And you know, you turn on the TV and it's, you know, like that. Having passed that tiny little deeply flawed bill is somehow responsible for Armageddon. And I do think that the reason that this is happening is because we are at a kind of crucible moment in the way that in women's evolution and in the way that we the kind of power we assert in society. I mean, it's an incredibly exciting moment. I hope that this kind of torment that we've experienced and we've imposed on ourselves and each other is a blip. And I hope that it's a step in the direction of a kind of, like I said, you know, moving towards a more sort of like the way we think about fatherhood, which is your job is to do the best you can and to be there and to provide for your kids. And also, incidentally, to like be Secretary of State. That too. Which is, and I think I hope that's going to be true for my kids. But, you know, my mother also thought that was going to be true for me. So maybe it will take more time than just the one generation. But, you know, on a hopeful note, I do think that it's an exciting time to live in. I mean, one of my daughters says that she wants to work for Doctors Without Borders and be a midwife. And my other daughter wants to be, if anyone is in the audience, my other daughter would like to be a movie producer. So please see me. But, you know, I spoke in that same language of my ambitions and goals that they speak in. But they also have a vision of the kind of man who will share their lives, and I think they're both expect to share their lives with men, that I think is just great. And their father, and that's because they have this role model of their dad who has, you know, really pulled, had been even more than an equal partner in the domestic sphere of our house. So it will all be wonderful for our daughters. It was just us. We got screwed, but that's all right. It'll be perfect for them. Perfect, perfect. They won't need to write their books. Although they are, I will tell you, they are all working on their tell-all memoirs as we speak. Every once in a while, I'll say something to my daughter, and I can see her going, note for later, payback. Turn around is fair play. Okay, guys, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm supposed to say that we're supposed to stop now, but I do want to say it is a big thrill on a June, you know, a Tuesday in June, and it's summertime, and to see all these people, and I think the LA Public Library and the Aloud series is kind of amazing.
Amazing. You guys have an incredible library. And a beautiful auditorium. Thank you so much for coming. It was a pleasure. We're both going to be signing books, and you are in for a real treat because Susan is one of my all-time favorite writers. So get her book.
Thanks.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.
A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.